Good morning. It's Tuesday, the 26th of August, and you're listening to the Wall Street Journal here on Sun Sounds of Arizona. This is your volunteer reader in Flagstaff, Chuck Kaufman, bringing you these headlines from the front page of the Wall Street Journal. Inside Intel's difficult dance, unexpected truce with Trump. President moves to oust governor from Fed. Russia feels fuel crunch as Kyiv hits refineries. Turning to that first headline, Inside Intel's Difficult Dance, Unexpected Truce with Trump. This article is by Robbie Whalen, Amrith Ramkumar, Lauren Thomas, and Joss Dossie. Lip-Bu Tan was anxiously preparing for the biggest meeting of his life. Just 5 months into his tenure as the chief executive of Intel, Tan was already fighting for his job. A few days earlier, Donald Trump had demanded he step down over his past ties to the Chinese military. The demand sent Intel's leadership into a panic. They immediately contacted the White House for a meeting, and Tan flew to Washington, huddling with his advisors for hours on Sunday, August the 10th. His team reassured him that the president would hear him out because Trump loves meetings with CEOs, even those whom he has attacked publicly, according to people with knowledge of the conversations. The next day, Tan met with Trump, Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick, and Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent in the Oval Office. He sought to convince the president that he wasn't a Chinese spy and that the U.S. government has a long-term interest in bolstering Intel, one of the only homegrown manufacturers of the computer chips that power the modern economy. The CEO's argument proved persuasive. The president also took a liking to Tan, a Malaysia-born, Singapore-raised U.S. citizen who once considered a career as a professional basketball player and backed off his demand for the CEO's ouster. But the truce came with a cost. In return for Trump's support, the administration proposed taking an equity stake in the company. It decided to convert nearly $9 billion in grants promised to Intel as part of the 2022 CHIPS Act into a 10% equity stake in the company, an unusual arrangement that makes the government Intel's biggest shareholder. The meeting was the pivot point in a frenzied period for Intel, once one of America's most venerated technology companies, now stuck in a years-long downward spiral. The company scrambled to control the fallout from the president's demand that Tan step down, triggered by a Fox Business Network segment, underscores the unpredictable environment major corporations face under Trump. By the end of the two-week roller coaster ride, Tan's job appeared to be secure and the company's situation more stable. On Friday, Intel and the White House officially revealed the terms of the deal. Japan's SoftBank Group agreed to invest $2 billion, seeking to curry favor with Trump. Yet a host of questions remain. Tan must resolve core business challenges to get his company on track. Some analysts say Intel isn't in a much better position. Without new commitments from customers, converting government grants to stock will only leave the company in a worse financial shape by diluting shareholders. Trump will likely need to find more ways to support Intel, not wanting it to fail on his watch. Intel needs a lot of help, and the U.S. needs Intel, said Jimmy Goodrich, senior advisor to the think tank RAND, who focuses on tech issues. Hopefully something good is going to come out of this. This account is based on interviews with current and former Intel and industry executives, administration officials, lobbyists, and company advisors. Left behind. Intel was founded in 1968 by semiconductor pioneers Robert Noyce, who co-created the modern computer chip, and Gordon Moore, originator of Moore's Law, the idea that computing power and chip efficiency would likely double every year or two, a guiding principle in the tech revolution. By the 1990s, Intel dominated the market for processors used in personal computers. Then came a series of strategic missteps. The company largely missed out on the mobile phone and artificial intelligence booms by overemphasizing short-term financial targets, analysts say. Rivals in chip design, like NVIDIA and manufacturers such as Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing, surged ahead. The company is still seen as key to reviving U.S. manufacturing. In his first term, Trump touted Intel's plans for a $7 billion manufacturing plant in Arizona. Trump advisors began discussing what became the CHIPS Act, wanting to attract companies such as TSMC to the U.S. As discussions on the CHIPS Act crescendoed during the Biden administration, Intel CEO Pat Gelsinger lobbied aggressively, hoping for some of the law's tens of billions of dollars in subsidies. Intel became the law's biggest beneficiary, qualifying for roughly $11 billion in grants and about $11 billion in loans for a plant in Ohio, an expansion in Arizona, and other projects. Seemed like a boom at the time, but the law's slow rollout and Intel's core business challenges led to repeated delays. Late last year, Tan, who had been an Intel director since 2022, left the board in protest of Gelsinger's strategy. The board also soured on Gelsinger and pushed him out. Trump's 2024 victory presented another curveball. He'd bashed Joe Biden's implementation of the CHIPS Act, fueling worries that he could try to change deals or cancel them altogether. Intel's financial condition worsened, and the incoming administration worried the company might fail. Even with the recent share price rebound following reports of the deal with Trump, the company is now valued at about $110 billion, a fraction of its dot-com bubble peak. The stock is down roughly 50% since the start of last year. Intel has been left behind, Trump said Friday. A very bad hand. Around Trump's inauguration in January, Lutnick and administration officials began evaluating CHIPS Act recipients. They asked semiconductor companies receiving awards to increase their total U.S. investment, but knew they might need to revamp Intel's deal or help the company in other ways. The administration began early conversations with Intel's board about taking an equity stake. The talks didn't move forward in part because the board, which has often been mired in disagreement, wanted more than the administration was willing to give. A former banker, Lutnick, has in recent months asked other tech executives what can be done to help Intel, even asking other chip companies like TSMC, Advanced Micro Devices, and Micron whether they'd consider potential deals involving the company. In March, Intel's board named Tan, 65, as CEO. One of the biggest decisions he faces is whether to keep the company as one of the few chip firms that does both design and manufacturing. Some analysts say Intel should consider splitting the businesses or doing other types of deals to cut costs. Tan has so far shied away from spinning off the manufacturing segment, which lost $3.2 billion in the second quarter. He's told confidants he inherited a very bad hand. In July, Intel said it would lay off 15% of its workforce by year-end, canceling billions in planned investments and further delay work on the sprawling Ohio plant. The new rules of the road were no more blank checks, Tan wrote in a memo to employees. Making a deal. Tan's early decisions at Intel were aimed at getting the company on more stable ground. But the CEO's past work at chip design software company Cadence Design Systems thrust the company into the spotlight. In late July, Cadence agreed to pay $140 million for violating U.S. export restrictions by selling banned technology to a Chinese national defense university. The sales happened while Tan was CEO. A week later, Senator Tom Cotton, Republican of Arkansas, sent a letter to Intel's board raising concerns about Tan's ties to China. Trump was watching Fox Business Network on August 7th when host Maria Bartiromo highlighted Cotton's criticism. 5 minutes later, Trump fired off a message on Truth Social. The CEO of Intel is highly conflicted and must resign immediately. It was one of the first times in modern history that the president publicly called for the leader of a major company to step down. Trump's demand was seen by some on both sides as an opening bid in negotiations with the CEO. The president had already grown intrigued by the idea of government stakes in key industrial companies during his May trip to the Middle East, a senior White House official said. Though the official added it wasn't what sparked Trump's post, the president wants to see more such deals in the future. In the Oval Office, Tan told the president his ties to Chinese businesses were years in the past and he was loyal to the U.S. He presented ideas for turning Intel around and investing more in the U.S. By the end of the hour-long discussion, the president was convinced and agreed to lay off the criticism. Tan and Lutnick then moved quickly to hammer out a deal for the government to take a minority stake in Intel. It was a complicated negotiation because it is unusual to convert government grants that have already been awarded into equity. While they were in the talks, SoftBank suddenly agreed to put $2 billion into the company, part of its campaign to bet on U.S. firms and appeal to Trump. SoftBank had already pledged to spend at least $100 billion in the U.S. on AI and other tech investments, a move announced by Son at Trump's Mar-a-Lago club last December. SoftBank had also earlier this year discussed a potential deal to acquire Intel's chip manufacturing business. Intel and the U.S. soon agreed the government would use $8.9 billion in grants that had been committed but not paid to take a nearly 10% equity stake. The U.S. won't have a say in governance. It already gave Intel $2.2 billion in CHIPS Act grants. The terms include a provision that the government could acquire another 5% of Intel at a discount if the company sells the majority of its manufacturing business. The administration insisted on the provision as a type of poison pill meant to dissuade the company from fully exiting the manufacturing segment. If Intel were to give the government another 5%, it would further dilute shareholders and complicate the company's finances. Finding customers. Despite the initial optimism, many analysts say the agreement will only be a boon for Intel if Trump can also help find customers and attract more investment for the company. That's fueled speculation that the president could lean on other tech companies to work with Intel. Tan has met with potential customers, including Apple CEO Tim Cook, trying to win support for Intel's next-generation manufacturing process. The administration's priority is helping the company start manufacturing the most advanced chips in the U.S. as soon as possible. That will likely include outreach to major customers. Tan has said Intel can't invest in its most sophisticated chip-making technologies until it secured major commitments from customers. Doing so would prove difficult. Many executives say they'd need big incentives to use Intel for manufacturing, given how badly it trails industry leaders like TSMC. It is difficult to switch semiconductor manufacturers because the processes are specialized and have to be planned out years in advance. The government's stake in Intel is the latest in a series of extraordinary interventions in the private sector launched by the administration. But it is among the most notable, given Trump called for Tan to resign, then quickly brought him to the negotiating table. There's this Darth Vader aspect of the whole thing, said Gautam Mukunda, a lecturer at the Yale University School of Management who studies innovation and leadership, referring to the Star Wars villain. If your situation with the administration can swing so radically in such a short span of time based on nothing more than a meeting, then it can always swing back, he said. On Friday, as Tan posed, smiling for a photo with Lutnick at the Commerce Department, the CEO had a real pep in his step, according to someone who saw him that day. As the pair gathered in the Oval Office in front of the president to sign the documents formalizing the government's stake, Trump proposed signing them as well. An unusual suggestion. The two men agreed, and the president added his autograph in large script, saying he hoped he could help make Intel great again. And that's Inside Intel's Difficult Dance, Unexpected Truce with Trump. Our next article is by Matt Grossman and Alex Leary. President moves to oust governor from Fed. Trump says he's determined there is sufficient cause to remove Lisa Cook. Washington. President Trump said he's removing Lisa Cook, a Joe Biden-appointed Federal Reserve governor, citing allegations that Cook submitted fraudulent information on mortgage applications. I have determined there's sufficient cause to remove you from your position, Trump wrote in a letter to Cook posted on social media on Monday night. Trump's decision comes days after Bill Pulte, the leader of the Federal Housing Finance Agency, alleged that in 2021, Cook sought mortgages on two properties, one in Michigan and the other in Atlanta, and described both of them as her primary residence, in papers submitted 14 days apart. Pulte said he would submit the information to the Justice Department in a criminal referral. In a statement, Cook said, "President Trump purported to fire me for cause when no cause exists under the law and he has no authority to do so. I will not resign. I will continue to carry out my duties to help the American economy as I have been doing since 2022. Cook said last week that she learned from the media that Pulte was making a criminal referral based on the mortgage applications. "I have no intention of being bullied to step down from my position because of some questions raised in a tweet," she said, adding that she would take questions about her financial history seriously. Trump said Friday that he'd fire Cook, the first black woman to serve on the Fed's board, if she didn't resign, though it is legally unclear whether the president possesses such power. Trump's Monday letter referenced the tremendous responsibility the Fed has for setting interest rates and regulating reserve and member banks. He added, "The American people must be able to have full confidence in the honesty of the members entrusted with setting policy and overseeing the Federal Reserve." His letter followed several days of ramped-up attacks on Cook. An image recently posted on Trump's social media account included a photo purporting to be Cook that displayed a red X over the photo and labeled her as the fraudster. Abby Lowell, a lawyer for Cook, said that Trump's move is flawed and his demands lack any proper process, basis, or legal authority. "We will take whatever actions are needed to prevent his attempted illegal action." The Fed didn't comment. Trump's attempt to fire Cook represents the most dramatic escalation of the campaign he's waged against the Fed since returning to office. Trump has continually castigated Fed Chair Jerome Powell's reluctance to cut interest rates. He's also hurled personal insults at Powell, lambasted him over alleged mismanagement of an expensive renovation of the Fed's Washington, D.C. headquarters, and has several times threatened to fire him. But so far, Trump has refrained from taking that step. Since the Fed's founding in 1913, occupants of the White House have occasionally lashed out at its policy choices, but no member of the Fed's seven-person board of governors has ever been targeted for removal by the president. Were Cook to dispute her firing in court, the legal battle would cover fresh ground. The Fed's founding legislation says that its governors can only be removed for cause. Job protection at independent federal agencies has been weakened by recent Supreme Court rulings and has never been tested in the context of the Fed. However, the Supreme Court suggested in May that Fed employees have more protections than employees at other agencies. A new opening on the Fed board would give Trump expanded leverage to shape its makeup. Powell's term as Fed chair ends in May. For months, Trump and his advisors have floated several potential successors in public. Meanwhile, two current Fed governors, Michelle Bowman and Christopher Waller, owe their seats on the board to Trump's nominations during his first term. This month, Trump nominated a close economic advisor, Stephen Miron, to fill a seat vacated by the resignation of Biden appointee, Adriana Kugler. Miron is awaiting confirmation by the Senate. The chance to fill Cook's seat would give Trump appointees a majority on the board. By design, the Fed is unusually insulated from the give and take of politics. Most economists argue that central banks work best when they are broadly independent from elected officials because monetary authorities, such as the Fed, sometimes have to make decisions that are painful in the short term to keep the economy on the right long-run path. Board members vote on monetary policy alongside a rotating group of five officials who oversee some of the Fed's regional reserve banks. These reserve bank presidents are appointed by local business leaders but must also win approval from the Fed board, which could give Trump-appointed governors even more sway. In 2023, Trump appointees Bowman and Waller abstained from supporting the nomination of Austin Goolsbee, a former Obama administration official, to lead Chicago's Reserve Bank. Last month, Bowman and Waller also both dissented against the Fed's most recent decision to hold interest rates steady, backing the Trump-aligned preference for rate cuts with detailed economic policy arguments. If Cook remains on the board, her term would expire in 2038. That's President Moves to Oust Governor from Fed. Our next item, Russia feels fuel crunch as Kyiv hits refineries. This is by Yaroslav Trofimov and Georgi Kanchev. The late Senator John McCain once called Russia a gas station with nukes. Now, because of Ukrainian attacks, it must ration fuel. The intensifying Ukrainian drone campaign against Russian refineries has taken some 13% of Russia's fuel production offline, some analysts said. Sanctions imposed by the West after the 2022 invasion, meanwhile, have limited Moscow's ability to repair infrastructure and service remaining installations. At the same time, the now frequent disruptions by Ukrainian drones to Russia's rail networks and airports have forced more Russians to travel by road during their summer holidays, just as fuel demand spiked because of the harvest season. As a result, several regions, including Russian-occupied Crimea and parts of Siberia, have implemented rationing at gas stations. Where gas is available, it is much more expensive. Russian wholesale prices for 95-octane gasoline have risen 45% this year, even as global crude oil prices have significantly declined. The war is not just on the front line, so any systemic hit has an asymmetric importance, said Pavlo Klimkin, Ukraine's former foreign minister. These strikes don't have a direct impact on military activity, but they do impact the Russian economy, and the Russian economy already has problems. So even a small push can create bottlenecks and multiply problems inside that system. Ukraine started hitting Russian refineries in 2023 as it developed its long-range drone industry. The Biden administration opposed these strikes at the time, fearing disruptions to the global oil supply. Until recently, Ukraine had by and large refrained from hitting Moscow's economic lifeline, its oil and gas export infrastructure. That's no longer the case. Ukrainian drones on Sunday set ablaze the strategic Ust-Luga facility on the Baltic Sea, a few days after the Druzhba pipeline that supplies Russian crude oil to Belarus, Hungary, and Slovakia was disabled. More than a dozen Russian refineries have been hit over the past month, some several hundred miles from the border, as Ukrainian drones become more potent and more numerous. Ukraine is now able to carry out sustained attacks. Last year it attempted that too, but the warheads were lighter and the success rate lower. What's happening now is that once the consequences of a strike are repaired, a new strike follows suit. And if Ukraine will be able to maintain this pressure and damage refineries more frequently than Russia is able to fix them, there will be a completely different situation, said Sergei Vakulenko, who served until 2022 as the head of strategy and innovation at Gazprom Neft, one of Russia's main state oil companies. Political leverage. The strikes also create political leverage for Kyiv as it navigates pressure from President Trump to end the war by acquiescing to at least some of Russia's demands. Since the spring, the Pentagon has restricted Ukrainian use of U.S.-provided ATACMS missiles to target Russia. Ukrainian-made weapons don't have these limitations. We constantly expand the scope of the strikes and improve the tactics. This shows that, yes, we depend on our partners, but we have also developed our own capabilities, our own cards, and have agency, said Mykola Bielevskov, a researcher at the National Institute of Strategic Studies, a think tank that advises the Ukrainian government, and a senior analyst at Come Back Alive, an organization that supplies the Ukrainian military. We are using against Russia the fact that it's so big there will never be enough air defenses there, he said. Russia's war machine is powered by exports of oil, gas, and fuel, which provides President Vladimir Putin with the means to recruit volunteers from the military with high sign-up bonuses despite mounting casualties. Trump, a Republican, has imposed a 25% additional tariff on India, which purchases some 38% of exported Russian crude oil. He told Prime Minister Viktor Orban of Hungary in a letter that he's very angry about Ukrainian strikes on the Druzhba pipeline. The latest strike took that facility offline for days. Game changer. In addition to drones, Ukraine is developing its own missiles, including the Flamingo cruise missile. With this much bigger warhead, the missile could become a game changer, said Fabian Hoffman, a missile expert at the University of Oslo, who closely follows the war in Ukraine. If you move from a long-range strike capability that's able to disrupt enemy industrial and economic targets to one that's able to comprehensively destroy them, that makes the whole thing a lot more difficult for Russia to deal with, he said. Russia will have to take into account that, as long as it continues this war, Ukraine will be able to really hurt Russia. Russia's economy has enjoyed relatively robust growth until recently, but persistent inflation, high interest rates, and Western sanctions have started to take their toll. The International Monetary Fund in July cut its growth forecast for Russian gross domestic product this year to 0.9%, down sharply from over 4% in 2024. High interest rates are a key reason why Russian fuel traders, who usually stock up on cheaper fuel in the winter to resell during the summer, haven't created a sufficient reserve this year. Recession risks. Russian officials are now openly warning of the risks of a recession as companies from tractor producers to furniture makers reduce output. The central bank in July cut its key rate to 18% from 20% as the economy shows signs of slowing. Rising prices at the pump threaten to add to inflation, which is hovering around 9%, further complicating the bank's task. Russia is highly sensitive to gasoline prices, and preventing sharp spikes is important for Putin's popularity and preventing domestic discontent, said Clayton Siegel, a senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington. At least six major Russian refineries have been hit this month, some repeatedly. Siegel said he expects some of them to be offline for at least 4 to 6 weeks. The Russian government has said the domestic market is fully supplied with fuel and has instructed oil companies to work on long-term measures to stabilize wholesale fuel prices. Russia introduced a ban on fuel exports in July in an effort to tame prices. Some analysts agree the fuel crunch by itself won't move the needle on Putin's strategic war aims in Ukraine or his domestic grip on power. It is painful, but not strategically disrupting, said Alexandra Prokopenko, a former Russian central bank official who's now a fellow at the Carnegie Russian Eurasia Center in Berlin. Yet any disruption matters in the kind of war that's waged in Ukraine, said Oleksiy Reznikov, Ukraine's former defense minister. Modern war is a war of resources, and Ukraine is a David that tries to find Goliath's weaknesses, he said. And that's Russia feels fuel crunch as Kyiv hits refineries. You're listening to the Wall Street Journal here on Sun Sounds of Arizona with your volunteer reader, Chuck Kaufman. Remember, you can listen to the Wall Street Journal and other Sun Sounds of Arizona programming, either streaming or at a time of your choosing, by going to the Sun Sounds of Arizona website at sunsounds.org or by downloading the Sun Sounds of Arizona app, now available for the Apple iPhone or iPad from the Apple App Store, or for your Android phone or tablet from the Google Play Store. And you can always listen to Sun Sounds of Arizona streaming on your Amazon Dot or Echo. Let's turn now to the business and finance section of the Wall Street Journal, and we have these headlines. Dillard's buys mall, bucking trend. A logging fight in Alaska risks Steinway's pianos. An auto plant full of robots still needs a human touch. So turning to that first headline by Kate King, Dillard's buys mall, bucking trend. Fashion apparel retailer partner pay $34 million for site in Longview, Texas. Big department store chains from JCPenney to Macy's are unloading their properties as fast as they can. Dillard's is buying real estate. The department store chain this month purchased the Longview Mall in Texas, about 2 hours east of Dallas. Dillard's and a partner paid $34 million for the 47-year-old mall in the city of Longview, according to a person familiar with the matter. The mall was available at the right price and is a longtime favorite of Chief Executive Bill Dillard. The company also wanted to make sure it didn't fall into the wrong hands. There are some bad actors out there in the mall industry that have been buying malls, said Chris Johnson, co-chief financial officer at Dillard's, who declined to name which ones. They're not paying their utility bills, not paying property taxes. Every mall they own deteriorates. Investors have been among the most active mall buyers in recent years as mall values plummeted and legacy mall companies unloaded their weaker properties. The most prolific buyers, Cohen Retail Investment Group and Namdar Realty Group, have snapped up malls at rock-bottom prices across the U.S. City officials have criticized and in some cases sued Cohen and Namdar, alleging they continue to collect rent from tenants while letting their properties fall into disrepair. Cohen and Namdar didn't respond to requests for comment. Namdar representatives have previously said the company is diligent in remedying maintenance issues at its properties. Retailers have complained, but most have the option of moving to a new shopping center when their leases expire. Department stores, by contrast, typically own the anchor space they occupy, and their fortunes are more deeply entwined with derelict mall ownership. It can have a negative impact on us, Johnson said. Our stores still do okay, but it's just a much better shopping experience if they maintain the mall. Chain store purchases of enclosed malls are rare, but not unheard of. Earlier this year, Walmart bought Monroeville Mall near Pittsburgh for $34 million. Home Depot purchased Charlottesville Fashion Square in Virginia in 2022. Department stores played an integral role in building and owning malls when development of these properties took off in the late 1960s, said Peter Gurney, a longtime real estate consultant. This practice ended by the early 1990s as mall construction slowed and department stores focused on shoring up their struggling businesses. It's been at least 30 years since a department store sorta, kinda owned a mall or was redeveloping a mall, he said. Few department stores these days have the resources to buy the malls they occupy. The sector is among the weakest performing segments in retail and has been losing customers for years to discount, specialty, and online stores. Many department store chains are closing malls and looking to wring out profits by selling their real estate. Macy's is aiming to generate as much as $750 million from asset sales by the end of next year. Last month, JCPenney's real estate holding company said it would sell 119 stores to a private equity firm for about $950 million. Dillard's, a fashion apparel retailer that sells clothing, cosmetics, and home goods, is bucking that trend. The publicly traded chain based in Little Rock, Arkansas, which owns most of its 272 stores, declined to comment on whether it would sell any real estate in the future or buy another mall. Dillard's maintains a loyal customer base and a strong balance sheet, with more than $1 billion in cash on hand as of the end of the second quarter. And that's Dillard's Buys Mall Bucking Trend. Our next headline, a logging fight in Alaska risks Steinway's pianos. This is by Ryan Ditzember. The decline of logging in Alaska's Tongass National Forest is reverberating to Astoria, Queens, where Steinway & Sons builds pianos in one of New York City's oldest operating factories. Steinway credits slow-growing Sitka spruce from the islands of the southeast Alaska with giving its pianos their sonorous sound. The piano's ribs, braces, soundboards, and white keys are all made from Sitka spruce. That supply is in jeopardy. Steinway's lone source of Sitka spruce, Viking Lumber, says it's running out of wood because of a lack of logging in the Tongass, which covers most of southeast Alaska. Viking's facility on Prince of Wales Island, 600 miles north of Seattle, is the Alaskan Panhandle's last big sawmill. It will close without Tongass timber sales, said Kirk Dahlstrom, one of Viking's owners. A last-minute deal with Alaska's government to cut state-owned timber will provide enough wood to run the mill through winter when the weather prohibits work in the forest, he said. Dahlstrom said he isn't sure how the mill will obtain wood next year. Closure would crush the economy of the island, where the biggest town, Craig, has about 1,000 residents. The sawmill employs about 45 people year-round, and truck drivers, barge pilots, loggers, and others would lose work as well. President Trump has called for increased timber harvests from federal forests as part of his push to boost the country's capacity to produce raw materials. He's contemplating tariffs on imported lumber in the name of national security. The Agriculture Department has begun the process of rescinding its roadless rule, which blocks road building or reconstruction on roughly 59 million federal acres and has impeded logging. Regional Forest Service supervisors were told to develop five-year plans to contribute to a 25% boost in the timber harvest on federal land. Neither initiative will solve Viking's immediate problem. Given how little wood was harvested from the Tongass in recent years, a 25% increase there would barely register at Viking's mill, Dahlstrom said. What's that? A week of wood, he said. It's like a pittance. Viking has bought a few small federal timber sales in recent years, but hasn't been offered a sizable tract since 2016, Dahlstrom said. That was the year a forest management plan was adopted for the Tongass that's been projected an annual harvest several times as large as it has been. In March, Viking, a local logging company, and the Alaska Forest Association sued the Forest Service, Agriculture Department, and Agricultural Secretary Brooke Rollins, claiming the government failed to live up to its end of the 2016 forest plan and unlawfully restricted logging of old-growth trees. Wood from old-growth forests is often the most sought after, yet ancient trees are typically the foundations of pristine and finely tuned ecosystems. In court filings, government lawyers contend that the 2016 plan merely maps out goals and doesn't bind the Forest Service to offer specific quantities or types of timber for sale. Tribal groups, fishing interests, and environmental groups intervened in the case in opposition to large-scale logging of old-growth forests. Although federal agencies and officials are the defendants in the case, they've been expressing support for Viking outside of the court. USDA remains committed to supporting locally based mills and responsible timber harvests in the Tongass National Forest, a Forest Service representative said. In a social media post, Rollins wrote, "We are on it. The people of Alaska and the timber industry deserve so much better than the political whiplash they've endured for decades." Dahlstrom started out as a sawyer in Washington State in 1978 when he and his brother built a sawmill to cut timber from the Olympic National Forest into building products. In the early 1990s, environmentalists who were worried about the aggressive logging of old-growth forests took what was then a novel approach and used the Endangered Species Act to sue on behalf of the threatened northern spotted owl. Logging restrictions ensued, and the volume of wood harvested from national forests plunged. Dahlstrom's business had a contract to supply hemlock to a garage door maker, so he and his partners bought a bankrupt sawmill on Prince of Wales Island and expanded their operation to Alaska, where there were plenty of old hemlocks and no northern spotted owls. There, Viking began cutting Sitka spruce, a strong yet lightweight wood. Japanese buyers who supplied piano makers across the Pacific Ocean were Viking's first spruce customers. Eventually, Viking began selling to Steinway, too. As other Alaskan mills closed, Viking became the only seller to Steinway. Steinway spruce is barged to Washington for further processing and trucked to New York, where the company has been making pianos since 1853. It is by far the most expensive type of wood that goes into Steinway pianos, which also feature hard rock maple, poplar, and mahogany, said Kyle Walters, the company's director of manufacturing. Steinway has plenty of spruce on hand to maintain its pace of making about 1,000 pianos a year in its New York factory, said Chief Executive Ben Steiner. Yet, the company is alarmed enough that it's written Alaska elected officials to advocate for Viking. Sitka Spruce's range extends down the Pacific coast into Northern California. But the trees that Steinway needs are in Alaska, where the brief growing season results in tighter grain than the spruce in the temperate rainforests of Washington and Oregon, Steiner said. That's what gives it its resonance, Steiner said. Nat's a logging fight in Alaska risks Steinway's pianos. We turn now to Auto Plant Full of Robots Still Needs a Human Touch. This is by John Kyleman from Ellabelle, Georgia. At Hyundai's Motor Group's ultra-modern new Auto Plant robots performing a stunning array of tasks. They move materials, attach doors, and do almost all of the welding. Dog-like robots with cameras in their snouts prance across the floor to inspect partially built ionic electric vehicles. The factory, which opened near Savannah, Georgia late last year, deploys 750 robots, not counting the hundreds of autonomous guided vehicles that glide across the floor. About 1,450 people work alongside them. That roughly 2-to-1 ratio of humans to robots compares with the U.S. auto industry average of 7-to-1. Human beings are still in the driver's seat for some jobs. They spot burrs that must be smoothed and bits of trim that need replacing. They snap fabric door panels into place with grommets, push electrical connectors together until they click, and duck into places robots can't reach to bolt down seats and attach shock absorbers. Hyundai Motor Company Chief Executive Jose Munoz said the factory was designed so the robots do tasks that are dangerous, repetitive, or physically demanding. People are left to troubleshoot, monitor quality, and bring craftsmanship to the manufacturing process. We're not trying to minimize human involvement, we're trying to maximize human potential, he said. No robot can do Eunice Yeoman's job. She works on the factory's metal finishing line, pulling out dents, sanding away imperfections, and removing adhesive and dust from freshly welded vehicle frames before they're whisked away to the paint shop. I don't think it's something that a machine can do because we have to be very hands-on with these cars, she said. The company is committed to hiring 8,500 people at the Ellabelle site by 2031 as a condition of the $2 billion incentive package it received from the state of Georgia. But some incoming employees, unnerved by the ubiquity of the plant's robots, wonder how long they'll be able to keep their jobs. Salem Ellsway, a postdoctoral fellow at Vanderbilt University who is writing a book about the history of industrial robots, said they're right to be worried. The minute humans become more expensive, more recalcitrant, the more automation you're going to get, he said. The age of industrial robotics began in 1961 when General Motors put a claw-handed machine called Unimate into a New Jersey factory, programming it to unload scalding hot parts from a die-casting press. Unimate was such a novelty that it was featured on The Tonight Show, where it poured a can of beer into a glass and conducted the house band. GM quickly staffed its factories with more robots, but the automation push created blowback. In 1972, the United Auto Workers struck for 22 days at a plant in Lordstown, Ohio, saying humans couldn't keep up with the pace set by the machines. The auto industry today is heavily roboticized, particularly in Hyundai's home country of South Korea. The country has one of the world's lowest birth rates, helping to drive its adoption of the machines, said Suzanne Beeler, a general secretary of the International Federation of Robotics. The U.S. has more than 400,000 unfilled manufacturing jobs, but Hyundai said the Ellabelle factory is meeting its hiring goals. Its starting hourly wage of $23.66 for entry-level workers is considerably higher than pay for comparable jobs nearby, said Brent Stubbs, the plant's chief administrative officer. New hires report to a state-funded training center to learn programming that teaches a robot to trace patterns with a marker, a precursor for teaching it how to weld and move objects from one place to another. Trainees also learn to work with their own eyes and hands. They check a completed sport utility vehicle for scratches, door gaps, and other imperfections beneath a canopy of fluorescent lights. They pick up handfuls of bolts until they can grab the right quantity by feel. A group of 20 new hires going through training on a recent morning had varying opinions about their mechanical colleagues-to-be. Some feared they'd be blamed if a robot made a mistake. Others worried a robot would eventually take their job. Stephanie Redman, who moved from Houston to work in the factory, said she was excited to join a high-tech workplace after a career in retail. "I just think it's going to be really cool," she said. The human workforce is sparse in much of Hyundai's plant. Metal arms move slabs of steel through presses that stamp them into components of the frame. An array of robots weld those parts together without a person in sight. It isn't until the frames emerge from the paint shop that people take over. Hundreds of workers are stationed along two assembly lines where seats, dashboards, and other components are added. At one station, a robot slides the powertrain beneath the frame and fastens it with several large bolts. Two workers' torque tools and hands add more. Tactile feel, knowing when a clip is fully inserted, being able to react to variability on the line, a wire harness that isn't quite routed, that's what people really do well, said Jerry Roach, head of the factory's General Assembly Department. Along with the robotic dogs, which go by the name Spot, Hyundai plans to deploy humanoid robots known as Atlas that have arms, legs, and fingers. Robot maker Boston Dynamics, in which Hyundai owns a controlling stake, has posted videos showing Atlas sorting and carrying parts. Hyundai declined to comment on the work it might do in Alabel. A complete robot takeover is decades away, said Jorgen Peterson, CEO of the Advanced Robotics for Manufacturing Institute, a government-funded nonprofit meant to strengthen U.S. manufacturing. Robots still struggle to handle fabric and other limp materials, he said, and performing the most complex jobs will take technological breakthroughs that aren't yet on the radar. The tasks that a human can do, the flexibility we have, the adaptability we have, we've underestimated it for a long time, Peterson said. People at the Hyundai plant hold primary responsibility for quality control, both along the assembly line and after a vehicle is finished. The final check comes at a track outside the factory where the Ionics arrive by autonomous guided vehicle for a test drive. Chico Murphy, the track team leader, steered an Ionic 9 SUV over pavement studded with bumps, listening for loose parts. He checked the brakes, paused at the summit of a steep hill, and hit highway speed on a straightaway. He said he and his colleagues occasionally discover issues that must be addressed before a vehicle is ready for sale. Murphy said as long as people drive cars, they'll want other people to give them a seal of approval. "I think they like knowing that a human is there," he said. "Just makes him feel a little safer than just relying on some machine." And that's Auto Plant Full of Robots Still Needs a Human Touch. Our next item is by Heather Haddon. Logo change spawns firestorm. Cracker Barrel planned to celebrate a fall menu and logo makeover with a festive country music concert in New York City, but its new logo stole the show, and not in a way the company intended. On Monday, the company apologized for how it communicated the changes, but didn't pivot from plans to keep updating the brand. The chain replaced its longtime logo, featuring a man in overalls leaning against a barrel, with a streamlined version featuring just the chain's name. The move engulfed the restaurant in a culture war firestorm, with commentators online and some customers accusing Cracker Barrel of eschewing its country charm and heritage for a sanitized image. Critics have lobbied personal attacks on social media against Julie Fels Massino, chief executive of the nearly 56-year-old chain. She scrapped a beloved American aesthetic and replaced it with sterile, soulless branding, wrote the Woke War Room on X in a message shared by Donald Trump Jr. She should resign and be replaced with leadership that will restore Cracker Barrel's tradition. The fallout has shaved tens of millions of dollars from the public company's market value, spawned calls for boycotts, and risked the casual dining chain's turnaround plan. Cracker Barrel has defended its changes, saying its All the More campaign was meant to honor its legacy while bringing new energy to the brand. Our values haven't changed, and the heart and soul of Cracker Barrel haven't changed, the company said. The new logo, the fifth iteration in its history, is a callback to the original one with its barrel shape and word design. On Monday, Cracker Barrel said the dust-up over the past several days had shown how deeply people care about the chain. We could have done a better job sharing who we are and who we'll always be, Cracker Barrel said. We know we won't get everything right the first time, but we'll keep testing, learning, and listening to our guests and employees. Cracker Barrel is the latest company to find itself roiled by America's charged political climate. Bud Light's promotion with a transgender influencer, Dylan Mulvaney, in 2023 prompted a boycott that has continued to hurt the parent company, AB InBev. Target stirred controversy with its 2023 Pride Month collection and backlash when it pulled back some of its diversity, equity, and inclusion efforts earlier this year. It's still unclear how much long-term damage Cracker Barrel might suffer as a result of the controversy. Some investors have backed Massino's efforts to update the brand and improve sales since she took over as CEO in 2023. The company's stock is down more than 9% over the 5 days since the controversy erupted, but even so, the stock is up around 32% over the past 12 months. Joining the chain after years at companies like Starbucks and Taco Bell, Massino has told investors that Cracker Barrel needed a shakeup. Lebanon, Tennessee company had been losing sales to other casual dining chains, particularly at dinner, and traffic last year was 16% lower than 2019 levels. Cracker Barrel received middling marks on food, value, experience, and convenience. We're not leading in any area. We will change that, Massino said in a May 2024 investor presentation. Massino embarked on a 3-year transformation of the brand, which included paying for store remodels and menu upgrades. After catering to retirees and families on road trips, Cracker Barrel now aspired to court younger guests. The company began updates in some of its roughly 660 Cracker Barrels to try to brighten up interiors and trim back the volume of tchotchkes in its decor. Cracker Barrel has played up the retro charm of some of its iconography along with its twofer. The sweatshirt that looks like it has a t-shirt underneath went viral on TikTok last year. For us, it's all about that authenticity, people who really love the brand and can help everybody enjoy it and see in it perhaps a new light, Massino said in June at the Wall Street Journal's Global Food Forum. Massino said the chain had done extensive customer research before making any of its updates. We're here to move them through it because we want them to love the brand. And that's Logo Change Spawns Firestorm. Our next item is from the Heard on the Street section. What margin debt says about markets. This is by Telus Demos. More investors are using borrowed money to buy shares, but this isn't necessarily a signal of a top. Margin borrowing may not be a great predictor of the S&P 500's next move, but it can still tell us something useful about how to invest. Borrowing that happens in brokerage accounts, often used to buy more stocks, is at an all-time high as of July and topped $1 trillion for the first time ever as of June, according to tracking by FINRA, which collects data from brokerages. The tempting inference is that more borrowing by investors means they're getting overly bullish and that any correction will be magnified as investors are forced to roll back their borrowing. Some especially quick rises in margin debt have preceded corrections. But there's a lesser-known driver of the growing size of margin debt, the rise of the market itself. Investors who borrowed shares to short sell them need to post collateral to their lenders. As share prices rise, they need to post more. That cash can be automatically drawn from a margin loan. So when stock prices rise, margin debt can become mechanically bigger. When that is the case, margin is no more useful than the S&P 500 point total in predicting the next move. Perhaps if margin borrowing by individual investors was surging faster than the overall total, it might be a signal of exuberance among that crowd. But FINRA doesn't track who's using the margin borrowing or for what purpose they are using it. However, there's one thing the rising level of margin debt does tell us. It's a great time to be in the brokerage business. Margin loan books grew well. Over 15% of both Charles Schwab and Interactive Brokers Group in the second quarter from a year earlier, for example. On top of the fees generated by trading volume, this helps fuel growth in net interest income, even with higher interest rates falling from a year ago. Robinhood Markets margin book grew 90% in the second quarter from a year earlier as the firm unveiled new pricing last year to attract more sophisticated individual traders. Even if it isn't a market top signal, though, margin levels still matter to some stocks. Shares of brokerages and Wall Street trading firms have been essentially supercharged bets on the rising market. Robinhood is up more than 400% over the past year, Interactive Brokers is up over 100%, and Schwab is up around 45%. Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs are up about 40%, and the S&P 500 is up 13%. But this can be a double-edged sword. If prices plunge, so can margin lending. Investors roll back borrowing to slash risk, and as collateral needs shrink, rather than grow, margin debits can become credits and interest income falls. So too can fees that are based on the value of assets or portfolios. This means revenues can drop on the downswing just as they rose on the upswing, and broker shares may fall faster on the downside too. So while margin debt won't tell you when the market will go down, it may tell you who could one day pay a stiff price. And that's what margin debt says about markets. An item from the Heard on the Street section of the Wall Street Journal. And you have been listening to the Wall Street Journal here on Sun Sounds of Arizona with your volunteer reader, Chuck Kaufman. Remember, you can listen to Sun Sounds of Arizona programming like the Wall Street Journal streaming on the Sun Sounds of Arizona website at sunsounds.org, on the Sun Sounds of Arizona app, available from the Apple App Store or the Google Play Store for your iPhone or iPad or your Android phone or tablet. And you can also listen to Sun Sounds of Arizona streaming on your Amazon Dot or Echo.